You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. On April 20th, 1999, the nation and the world watched in horror as the massacre unfolded at Columbine High School in Colorado. As details emerged of the 15 lives lost that day, including those of the killers, people blamed violent movies and video games, bullying, heavy metal music, and easy access to weapons, along with inattentive and indulgent parenting.
From the moment that she learned her son was one of the killers, up to today, Sue Klebold has been trying to make sense of that tragedy, to come to terms with the boy she thought she knew and yet could take the lives of fellow students and a teacher, as well as his own.
Sue Klebold has gone on to work for mental health awareness and violence prevention. She's the author of the book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you have said that you feel what you call a moral imperative to share your story with the world. Why is that? Why do you feel that moral imperative?
It's very difficult to be the mother of a killer. And I felt that having this horrible, sad, and tragic event changed me significantly, and it changed my awareness about health and about communication and about many things. And I just felt that it was my responsibility to share what I had learned. Perhaps that's because I had been a teacher, and I always feel that it's my responsibility to share knowledge.
Is it your hope that what you have learned can prevent future tragedies, or is it also, in a sense, to bear witness?
It's everything. It's both of those things. The chances that someone you love would be involved in something as terrible as this or be the perpetrator of a mass shooting, the chances are one in millions. But the chances that someone you love may be struggling with toxic thoughts or thoughts of suicide, that is a much higher percentage. And I feel that for every one of us, mental health issues will be a part of our life in some way at some time. And I think that it's something that we should all know more about and be aware that regardless of how people act, they can be suffering greatly behind the mask that they wear.
And you've been struggling with how to reconcile your love as a mother for a son and, in a way, a life, a whole family life that you had before Columbine, before the shooting, and also the son you had who was a mass shooter who took lives. And I wonder if you could start by telling us about the first Dylan, the Dylan that you knew and loved before the tragedy.
The Dylan that I knew from the time he was just a tiny guy was very cherubic. He had blonde, curly hair and blue eyes, and he was impish, and he was extremely smart and clever, and he could... You know, he was doing equations with magnets on the refrigerator when he was still wearing a diaper at night. I mean, he was smart. He sort of taught himself everything, how to read. When he was 4 years old, he was reading books like Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little silently to himself. It seemed that everything in Dylan's life came easily to him, and he was somebody who had such a zest for life. He loved to learn. He loved to discover. He loved origami, and he played chess, and he, you know, loved mazes and puzzles. He would dump all of the puzzles into a huge pile and work five of them at the same time because he wanted the extra challenge. I marveled at this child. He made me feel like the best parent in the world because he required very little discipline and guidance because he seemed to know how to live his life and live it well, and everything, most things, came very easily to him.
And on the other side of things, there was a Dylan that you didn't know, that he kept very private, and you saw in what's been called the basement tapes, a video of him, a son you hadn't seen before, and a very anguished, depressive Dylan in some of his own writings. What did you make of that person who was also your son, but a person that you hadn't known?
When Dylan reached adolescence, he changed a lot. He became much more shy. He was always an introvert, but I could see that he was extremely uncomfortable in his own skin, as many teens are. His joy for learning abated. He didn't have that thirst for learning new things. I saw this as normal. mocking behavior. What was happening with Dylan was, I thought he was transitioning into adulthood in a normal way, becoming more sensitive, more self-conscious. But the things that were happening in his mind were very dangerous, and I didn't see this until after, not only after this incident happened, but until long after it happened, when I was finally able to see his writings and see that he was expressing his own level of agony. He would say, "I am in agony." He wrote about cutting himself and wanting to die and wanting to get a gun 2 years before he died. And what I really felt on discovering these things was just anguish, that my son had been suffering and I didn't help him. I didn't make him better. I didn't find a way to save him. And primarily that is what I felt, was my own terrible feelings of guilt and self-loathing that this had happened and that my son was suffering and I hadn't been able to do anything about it.
And I think that aspect is what terrifies parents. You've said that the other parents sometimes read your book so that they can maybe figure out what happened in the case of Dylan and the Columbine shooting and maybe avoid it. And on the one hand, you're saying maybe you can always know. What do you think parents should take away from this?
What I tell parents and what I hope parents will take away from this, there are several messages. One is we have this belief system sometimes as parents that if we love our children enough, that our love is protective of them, and that if we love them and we tell them we love them, then they would never feel despondent enough to do any kind of violent act toward themselves or someone else. And that, I would say, I learned is a myth, that we can't love away depression. We can't love away these suicidal feelings and thoughts. It takes more than love. The other thing I encourage parents to do, and this is things I regret that I did not do, was the manner in which we talk to our children and we listen to our children. We must do a better job. Most of us, when we speak with our children, we are very quick to try to help them feel better, to fix what they're feeling. You know, we're going to get on this. We're going to take you to a counselor. What we, most of us, certainly I did, and other parents I've spoken with, we're very uncomfortable asking our children to share with us just how much they are hurting and what their issues are. Very few of us are comfortable asking our children if they feel suicidal, if they're feeling like they wish they could go to sleep and not wake up, because that is a very difficult thing to say, but the experts are telling us that that is a necessary part of our conversation. If we observe things that show that our kids are hurting or there's a change in behavior or sleep patterns, or if they're talking about giving away their possessions or wishing that they could not be here, it is very important to ask that question of whether or not someone is thinking of ending their lives. Now, Dylan did not display those things in front of me, but he was showing some of those signs to different people. For example, he purchased a gun, and just the acquisitions of firearms is an indication that someone might be planning their own death. And he had friends that knew that, but we as parents did not.
Now, going back to these two Dylans, the one you knew and loved and the one you didn't know so well, you've done so much processing. Are you closer to being able to reconcile the two of them?
I think I am, and I think I have. What I eventually came to in my mind was that, and many people are going to be offended by what I'm going to say, but in my mind, Dylan was experiencing some kind of a brain health issue that impaired his access to the tools that would have helped him cope with this, recover from this, get away from it. So in my mind, Dylan became ill, and he was a victim of the tragedy that he helped perpetrate. And when I have talked with other survivors of suicide loss, when their loved one did not kill other people but died by suicide, that is the way most of us have come to think of us, is that a brain health condition of some kind, took our loved one away from us.
We're talking with Sue Klebold right now, the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the two shooters at Columbine High School in 1999 who killed 13 people before ending their own lives. Her book is called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And the author's shares of the profit from that book are going toward mental health awareness and suicide prevention. Sue, you advocate for use of the term brain health instead of mental health. Why do you like that phrase and feel that it's more helpful in addressing these issues?
One of the experts I talked to introduced that concept to me, and I thought it was very wise. When we think of mental illness, we have hundreds of years of stigma around that term. It's a very loaded word. Mental illness are very loaded words and concepts. Most of us have a lot of gut-level reactions to that, fear, of misunderstandings. When I think of brain health rather than mental health, it takes it out of the realm of mind and more into the concept of biology, because I feel that much of what goes on when one is having issues, mood disorders, other kinds of mental illnesses, it is a brain health issue, and the brain is an organ in our body. It affects not only our thoughts and our minds, but it has a biological connection to our sympathetic nervous system. It is a brain health issue, and I think if we start looking at these things in a more holistic manner and thinking about this is something that happens to one's brain where they cannot think and reason the way we do, or they see the world differently than we do, then I think it kind of destigmatizes it and helps us think about it a little bit differently and a little bit more concretely.
With the distance of almost two decades, have you been able to forgive your son, to forgive Dylan, or to forgive yourself?
Forgiving Dylan was never anything I felt that I had to do, other than a very brief time after his death when I saw the basement tapes and I saw how this tremendous level of depravity and sadism and anger and all these horrible behaviors that he exhibited at the time of his death. But after I came to grips with thinking about what Dylan was experiencing in his mind, what were the influences in his life, I got to read his writings, and they were not filled with hate and planning for murder. They were full of love and longing. And the piece that has stayed with me is not the need to forgive Dylan for what he did. It is the need to forgive myself. And there is a piece of me that I will never forgive not being the mother that Dylan needed me to be. But the way I cope with that is I'm doing the things that I do. You know, I have written a book and could donate my share of the profits. I try to speak. I try to talk with other parents to help other survivors of loss. I kind of feel that, in a way, that paying it forward and trying to change things is something I can do to help myself, to forgive myself.
Sue, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Sue Klebold is the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of two shooters at Columbine High School in 1999, who killed 13 people before ending their own lives. She's now an advocate for mental health awareness and violence prevention. She's the author of the book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The news is next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.